The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the October 24th, 2014 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Health officials struggle to contain Ebola. What happened? Doubts grew this week that U.S. health officials are equipped to stop the spread of Ebola, after two nurses at the Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital in Dallas contracted the lethal virus while caring for a patient who has since died. Amber J. Vinson, 29, was diagnosed with Ebola days after Nina Pham, 26, tested positive for the disease. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said it would monitor the health of 132 passengers who flew on a commercial jet from Ohio to Dallas with Vinson the day before she was diagnosed. A nurses' union released a blistering statement accusing the CDC and Dallas hospital officials of providing inadequate protective gear and poor training. "We've had a country in mass denial about a dangerous epidemic," said nurse Roseanne DeMuro. The CDC promised to send a rapid response team to any U.S. hospital that receives an Ebola patient in the future. The World Health Organization revised Ebola's fatality rate upward to 70% and warned West Africa could see up to 10,000 new cases per week by December. With the CDC struggling to contain Ebola, Republicans strongly criticized President Obama for declining to close the border to travelers from three West African countries at the epicenter of the outbreak: Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia. In response, Democrats joined the National Institutes of Health in blaming Ebola's spread on Republican budget cuts. "Frankly, if we had not gone through our 10-year slide in research support, we probably would have had a vaccine in time for this," said NIH Director Francis Collins. What the editorial said: "Just 2 weeks ago," said the New York Daily News, "CDC Chief Thomas Frieden nonchalantly dismissed the threat of Ebola, stating, 'I have no doubt that we will stop it in its tracks in the U.S.' Today, it's clear that health officials seriously underestimated this virulent disease, and trust in the CDC is rapidly diminishing." Nurses at Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital say the Ebola patient they treated, Thomas Eric Duncan of Liberia, died in a room extensively contaminated with vomit and diarrhea, while they were equipped with absurdly deficient protective gear, which left their necks exposed until they wrapped them with makeshift tape. "When the contagion breaks out," said USAtoday.com, "fear invariably spreads faster than the virus. It was true of AIDS in the 1980s and SARS a decade ago, and it's true today with Ebola. But Ebola has killed just one person in America, while in Nigeria, health officials have managed to completely shut down the disease's transmission. This isn't reason to relax, but it is reason for a calm, deliberate focus on containment." What the columnist said: "A nurse should not have contracted Ebola," said Jonathan Cohn in NewRepublic.com. "Clearly, CDC safety protocols are inadequate. Experts say it's easy for healthcare workers to contaminate themselves while taking off protective clothing or just scratching their nose. Expecting workers who have never seen Ebola before to get the protocols right every single time is asking an awful lot. That's why President Obama should close U.S. borders to West Africans," said Ben Carson in NationalReview.com. Why bring infected individuals into our midst when we can readily treat them elsewhere? Actually, a travel ban will not stop Ebola spread, said Julia Belluz in Vox.com. Direct flights from West Africa are rare, and travelers could easily circumvent the restrictions by hopping on an indirect flight, and then they won't be examined or tracked. Worse, making pariah states of those countries would devastate their economies and heighten the risk of global pandemic. Thanks to cynical exploitation by politicians and cable news shows, Americans are now thoroughly freaked out about Ebola, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. But a little perspective, please. 2 people out of 316 million have contracted the disease, while 24 Americans have died in lightning strikes this year. Your chances of contracting Ebola remain infinitesimal. If you find yourself with symptoms including anxiety, sweating, and clutching your chest, you've probably been watching too much television. But it wasn't all bad. Larry Hester has been blind for half his life. But last week, the 66-year-old saw for the first time in 3 decades, thanks to a newly implanted bionic eye. Hester is one of just a handful of U.S. patients to be fitted with a high-tech retinal prosthesis, which allows him to distinguish light from dark. When his doctor turned on the device, Hester was ecstatic. "It was incredible. It was bright, and it was significant," he said. "It was hard to articulate what I was feeling, but I wanted to share it with everybody." Our controversy of the week: death with dignity. Should other states adopt Oregon's law? Brittany Maynard is a beautiful newlywed with a loving husband and a passion for the outdoors, said Samantha Allen in thedailybeast.com. And on November 1st, she plans to kill herself. Maynard, 29, was diagnosed with a malignant brain tumor in January and told in April that she had only 6 months to live. After discussions with her family, Maynard moved with her husband to Oregon, one of only 5 U.S. states that allow doctor-assisted suicide, where a doctor prescribed a vial of lethal medication that Maynard plans to ingest in her own bed with her husband and mother at her side. In the few weeks she has left, Maynard has become a remarkably effective campaigner for assisted suicide to be legalized nationwide. "I do not want to die," said Brittany Maynard in CNN.com, "but I do not want to live into the end stage of this illness, when the fast-growing tumor would eat deeply into my brain, changing my personality, stealing all motor and cognitive control, and inflicting pain even morphine couldn't mask. All that I and people like me ask is that we be allowed to exert what little control we still have over our destinies by choosing a death with dignity. Who has the right to tell me that I don't deserve this choice?" Maynard's case is heartbreaking, said Marilyn Golden, also in CNN.com. "But it's hardly typical. If assisted suicide laws went nationwide, it would create explicit and implicit pressure on millions of elderly, disabled, and chronically sick poor people to do the decent thing and end their lives prematurely. A bottle of pills costing $300, after all, is the cheapest treatment for a terminal illness. All of us can imagine horrible circumstances in which we'd want the same choice as Maynard's," said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. "But establish the right of sick individuals to kill themselves, and that right begins to look more and more like an expectation. This isn't a society we want to live or die in." "With proper legal safeguards, those fears are groundless," said Thaddeus Pope in NYTimes.com. "The Oregon law requires 2 doctors to certify the patient has less than 6 months to live. She must then pass a battery of tests to prove she isn't depressed, acting impulsively, or being coerced. After all that, if she still chooses to go through with it, she must administer the medication herself. These safeguards work. Since the law went into effect in 1997, only 750 Oregonians have ended their lives with a doctor's help, all meeting the proper criteria. There is no slippery slope of poor elderly or disabled people clamoring to die. That's why other states and countries have looked to Oregon as a model. It would be a mistake to jump on that bandwagon, said Maggie Carner in TheFederalist.com. I was recently diagnosed with the same form of aggressive brain cancer as Brittany Maynard. But assisted suicide isn't for me. As my three daughters care for me, just as I once cared for my paraplegic father, they are receiving a rich, deeply spiritual lesson in compassion, selflessness, and human mortality. Yes, death sucks, but there is no tragedy in surrendering to dependence on others or even to suffering. Rather than comfort myself with the illusion of control in these last months, I draw comfort from what my Christian religion teaches. Death is always out of our hands. Well, it was a good week for reclaiming the skies. After a hawk attacked a remote-controlled drone intruding into its airspace, forcing it to crash land in a Massachusetts park. The hawk came out unscathed, said the drone's owner, Christopher Schmidt, and having defeated his prey, was happy to retreat. It was a good week for monetizing content after a comedy club in Barcelona used a facial recognition technology to track how much audience members enjoyed a show, adding 0.3 euros, 38 cents, to their bill for every time they laughed. It was a good week for boots on the ground after Dutch officials gave their approval to members of the Dutch No Surrender biker gang going to Syria to join Kurds fighting the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. It was a bad week for small indiscretions after a Spanish newlywed was forced to admit to having sex with a dwarf stripper at her bachelorette party when she gave birth to a baby with dwarfism 9 months later. It was a bad week for clowning around after police in Kern County, California, received at least 20 reports of clowns wielding baseball bats and machetes and terrifying children. There's a natural phobia of clowns, said a police spokesman. If someone is dressed up as a clown and holding a weapon, that's going to frighten people. And it was a bad week for changing your mind. After a Washington State man allegedly robbed a bank and then waited outside until police arrived and arrested him. Police said the man, Richard Gorton, 64, became remorseful right after he walked out of the bank. On the briefing page, Rise of the Machines. Computers could achieve superhuman levels of intelligence in this century. Could they pose a threat to humanity? How smart are today's computers? They can tackle increasingly complex tasks with almost human-like intelligence. Microsoft has developed an Xbox game console that can assess a player's mood by analyzing his or her facial expressions. And in 2011, IBM's Watson supercomputer won Jeopardy, a quiz show that often requires contestants to interpret humorous plays on words. These developments have brought us closer to the holy grail of computer science, artificial intelligence, or a machine that's capable of thinking for itself, rather than just respond to commands. But what happens if computers achieve superintelligence, massively outperforming humans not just in science and math, but in artistic creativity and even social skills? Nick Bostrom, director of the Future of Humanity Institute at the University of Oxford, believes we could be sleepwalking into a future in which computers are no longer obedient tools, but a dominant species with no interest in the survival of the human race. Once unsafe superintelligence is developed, Bostrom warned, we can't put it back in the bottle. When will AI become a reality? There's a 50% chance that we'll create a computer with human-level intelligence by 2050, and a 90% chance we will do so by 2075, according to a survey of AI experts carried out by Bostrom. The key to AI could be the human brain. If a machine can emulate the brain's neural networks, it might be capable of its own sentient thought. With that in mind, tech giants like Google are trying to develop their own brains, stacks of coordinated servers running highly advanced software. Meanwhile, Facebook co-founder Mark Zuckerberg has invested heavily in Vicarious, a San Francisco-based company that aims to replicate the neocortex, the part of the brain that governs vision and language and does math. Translate the neocortex into computer code, and you have a computer that thinks like a person, said Vicarious co-founder Scott Phoenix, except it doesn't have to eat or sleep. Why is that a threat? No one knows what will happen when computers become smarter than their creators. Computer power has doubled every 18 months since 1956, and some AI experts believe that in the next century, computers will become smart enough to understand their own designs and improve upon them exponentially. The resulting intelligence gap between machines and people, Bostrom said, would be akin to the one between humans and insects. Computer superintelligence could be a boon for the human race, curing diseases like cancer and AIDS, solving problems that overwhelm humans, and performing work that would create new wealth and provide more leisure time. But superintelligence could also be a curse. What could go wrong? Computers are designed to solve problems as efficiently as possible. The difficulty occurs when imperfect humans are factored into their equations. Suppose we have an AI whose only goal is to make as many paperclips as possible, Bostrom said. That thinking machine might rationally decide that wiping out humanity will help it achieve that goal, because humans are the only ones who could switch the machine off, thereby jeopardizing its paperclip-making mission. In a hyperconnected world, superintelligent computers would have many ways to kill humans. They could knock out the internet-connected electricity grid, poison the water supply, cause havoc at nuclear power plants, or seize command of the military's remote-controlled drone aircraft or nuclear missiles. Inventor Elon Musk recently warned that we need to be super careful with artificial intelligence, calling it potentially more dangerous than nukes. Is that bleak future inevitable? Many computer scientists do not think so, and question whether AI is truly achievable. We're a long way from understanding the process of our own incredibly complex brains, including the nature of consciousness itself, let alone applying that knowledge to produce a sentient, self-aware machine. And though today's most powerful computers can use sophisticated algorithms to win chess games and quiz shows, we're still far short of creating machines with a full set of human skills. Ones that could write poetry and have a conception of right and wrong, said Ramez Nam, a lecturer at the Silicon Valley-based Singularity University. That being said, technology is advancing at lightning speed, and some machines are already capable of making radical and spontaneous self-improvements. What safeguards are in place? Not many thus far. Google, for one, has created an AI ethics review board that supposedly will ensure that new technologies are developed safely. Some computer scientists are calling for the machines to come pre-programmed with ethical guidelines, though developers then would face thorny decisions over what behavior is and isn't moral. The fundamental problem, said Danny Hillens, a pioneering supercomputer designer, is that tech firms are designing ever more intelligent computers without fully understanding or even giving much thought to the implications of their inventions. We're at that point analogous to when single-celled organisms were turning into multi-celled organisms, he said. We're amoeba, and we can't figure out what the hell this thing is that we're creating. When robots learn to lie. In 2009, Swiss researchers carried out a robotic experiment that produced some unexpected results. Hundreds of robots were placed in arenas and programmed to look for a food source, in this case, a light-colored ring. The robots were able to communicate with one another and were instructed to direct their fellow machines to the food by emitting a blue light. But as the experiment went on, researchers noticed that the machines were evolving to become more secretive and deceitful. When they found food, the robots stopped shining their lights and instead began hoarding the resources, even though nothing in their original programming commanded them to do so. The implication is that the machine learned self-preservation, said Louis Del Monte, author of The Artificial Intelligence Revolution. Whether or not they're conscious is a moot point. Moving on to the columns, this comes from Michael Gerson at the Washington Post. Proof that isolationism doesn't work. Americans are understandably sick of rescuing the world, said Michael Gerson, but we're now being reminded why we have no choice. After the messy interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan, 52% of Americans polled in 2013 said that the U.S. should mind its own business internationally. But when President Obama ignored the civil war in Syria, it created a vacuum that's been filled by the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, whose savagery now threatens the entire region. And the world's slowness in responding to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa has led to a widening epidemic. The reality is that since World War II, the U.S. has been the only nation willing enough, capable enough, and responsible enough to keep the semblance of order in a chaotic, divided world. It is still the U.S. naval fleet that protects Asian nations from China's aggression, our army that guards the Korean demilitarized zone, and our air force that's conducting most of the airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. Only U.S. resources can keep Ebola from becoming a global epidemic. Isolationism is tempting, but foolish. We face problems that can't be isolated, only confronted. From Germany, Caroline Fetscher at Der Tagesspiegel writes, "This food fad is far from harmless." Veganism is Germany's new secular cult, said Caroline Fetscher. Some 9 million Germans, more than 10% of the population, are vegetarians, and another 500,000 people subscribe to veganism, the strict avoidance of all animal products and foods, even eggs and milk. Vegan cafes, restaurants, and grocery stores are springing up everywhere. Travel companies offer vegan cruise deals. Vegan cookbooks have been bestsellers. There's even a vegan elementary school. Harmless enough, or even laudable, you might think. But there's a disturbing aspect to this burgeoning craze. During Germany's crisis-hit 1920s, food taboos and fad diets took off in a big way, often in concert with superstitions like fortune-telling and astrology. In a world ever more menaced by such overwhelming threats as war, terrorism, and deadly pandemics, veganism seems to offer clarity and guidance. Powerless in the face of political and social disruption, people feel that at least they can subject their own bodies to total control. But this retreat from the world is unhealthy. A broken world can only be mended by facing up to reality, not by headlong flight into a safe cocoon. These plant eaters are not as harmless and apolitical as they seem to believe. From Pakistan, why Malala isn't a hero at home? The Nobel Committee has given a nation starved of glad tidings reason to celebrate, said Dawn in an editorial. The organization last week awarded its annual Peace Prize to girls' education campaigner Malala Yousafzai, making the 17-year-old Pakistani the youngest ever Nobel laureate. Malala, who shared the prize with Indian child's right activist Kailash Satyarthi, began her courageous campaign at age 12, writing blogs and giving speeches condemning the Pakistani Taliban for banning girls from attending school in the remote Swat Valley, where she grew up. Even after a Taliban militant shot her in the head at point-blank range in October 2012, she did not waver. Malala continued to speak out and become a global icon who represents the millions of children out of school in the world, whether for reasons of war, militancy, or state neglect. This prize is a victory not only for Malala, but also for Pakistan, said Malik Muhammad Ashraf in the News International. We should be proud that our nation has shown impregnable solidarity in standing with this brave girl against religious extremism. If only that were true, said Marvi Sirmed in The Nation. In fact, many Pakistanis view Malala as a Western stooge and think her Nobel win has some hidden agenda to ultimately malign us. Maulana Gul Naseeb, a prominent figure in one of Pakistan's main religious political parties, has claimed that U.S. officials created Malala in order to promote their own culture of nudity and to defame Pakistan. Other Pakistanis accuse her of exploiting the country's troubles to become famous overseas. The anger against Malala is so extreme that the teen, who now lives in Britain with her family, can't return home out of fear of another assassination attempt. This backlash is driven by shame, said Shaista Aziz in The Observer. An estimated 25 million school-aged children are missing out on an education in Pakistan, including at least 13 million girls. And the government seems powerless to stop militants from blowing up girls' schools. Malala is a mirror through which Pakistanis are forced to view themselves, and they don't like what they see. What's truly pathetic about Pakistan's reaction to this prize, said Mina Malik Hussein in The Nation, is that Malala is being honored for the things we all want to be recognized for: courage, freedom, and justice. The Nobel Committee has sent a powerful message to the subcontinent by giving this year's award to Malala and Satyarthi, who have dedicated their lives to the rights of children. These brave activists are working to build a future in which our little ones would enjoy universal education and childhoods free of fear and violence. If only we could too. And we turn now to the last word. A new way of hearing. After I was deaf for decades, said Josephine Dickinson, a cochlear implant gave me a new experience of sound. When I woke up one morning and found I could hear nothing, my biggest sense of loss came from being unable to listen to my older brother and sister playing my favorite Diabelli duet. Down on the floor between my siblings' feet, I tried desperately to retrieve something of the music by touching the piano body, but to little avail. I was 6 years old. A few months later, I got my first standard-issue hearing aid and began to hear speech. though I understood it only in certain favorable conditions, mainly one-to-one in a quiet environment. The powerfully amplified sound was partial and distorted, a fact that brought home to me when I learned to read and play music myself and saw with my own eyes the limitations and imperfections of what I was hearing. In time, music would become essential to my existence, the heartbeat and oxygen of my artistic, emotional, and spiritual life. From playing the piano for friends and giving recitals at poetry readings, I graduated to teaching and composing. Although profoundly deaf, I became a hearing musician with a distortion problem and a bias toward lower frequencies. I couldn't make out the words of a song or aria, but I could appreciate the exquisite subtleties of harmony in an orchestral piece of whose detail I could only hear a small fraction. I heard in an acoustic fashion, my damaged inner ear supplemented by the amplification of powerful hearing aids. I heard music better than speech. Then on Sunday, April 29th, 2012, as I was driving to a tango class, my hearing aid seemed to sputter out. I could hear nothing. Jiggling the mold in my ear, I wondered whether it had become blocked with wax or if it needed new batteries. Perhaps the altitude of the pass where I was driving was making my ears popped, as had happened before on aircraft. I resigned myself to tangoing without sound, relying on aligning my follower movements to my partner's leader ones to compensate for losing the subtle sense of rhythm and feeling. It was strangely disorienting. The tutor took me in hand, tapping the rhythm on my shoulder. I felt flustered and awkward. Then, at the end of the class, as we gathered around a display of paintings of tango dancers, I was knocked off my feet by a sudden tsunami of sound, a great roar that I felt right through my body, getting louder and louder. This was tinnitus, my brain's response to being deprived of all stimulus to the auditory cortex. At home, I put on a CD, turned the volume to maximum, and put fresh batteries in my hearing aid. Nothing. I placed my hands on the CD player, thirsty for any drop of vibration. But all I got was the tinnitus, which continued relentlessly for 20 months, until I received a cochlear implant. "Are you deliberately talking funny?" I asked the audiologist. Naomi smiles. "No, it's your brain picking out the high frequencies." I can see her mouth opening and shutting, forming the words, but all I hear is a high-pitched monotone, a rapid, brittle tink, tink, tink. When I take out my shiny, bow-shaped sound processor, then slide the transmitter over my scalp till I feel the pull of a magnet under my skin, there's a crackle, as of a sensitive microphone being switched on. Then comes a clatter as my feet knock on the floor, and the shwoom of my in-breath. These are not sounds as a naturally hearing person hears them, nor are they like the sounds I perceived with hearing aids before that fateful tango class. My brain is adjusting to new signals beamed direct to the auditory nerve. The day of the switch-on came 4 weeks into my post-operative healing. Naomi started by sending signals from the computer. I heard a high-pitched mechanical beeps. Suddenly, my brain grabbed at the tone, its first real auditory input for nearly 2 years, and went off on a mighty jam session, weaving and jiving in and around the tones until I could no longer distinguish one from another. A cochlear implant has two main components: a processor, which hooks over the outer ear and is attached to a magnetic transmitter, and a receiver device implanted by the surgeon under the scalp. This is attached to an array of 22 electrodes and is threaded through the round window opening of the cochlea in the inner ear, into the scala tympani, and pushed through its coil for as much as 1.25 turns. The electrodes come to rest against the tissue rich with hair cells that transmit signals via the auditory nerve to the auditory cortex, where they're interpreted as sound. To give you some idea of the difference between this and natural hearing, a healthy cochlea will have not 22, but as many as 20,000 outer hair cells bunched onto 3,500 inner hair cells that connect to the auditory nerve. The cochlea is tonotopically arranged so that it picks up frequencies along its length, the highest pitches at its base, the lowest at its apex. Obviously, pitch perception with a cochlear implant is going to be very limited. The electrodes are blunt instruments for place pitch, which depends on where the impulse is received. However, given that pitch itself is a construct of the brain and that the brain has a plasticity without which the cochlear implant almost certainly could not work, it should be possible over time for me to develop improved pitch perception. Even during the switch-on, when the electrodes had been working for over an hour, I was already beginning to hear a broader spectrum of frequencies in Naomi's voice. It began to sound more normal. Then again, the cochlear implant cannot process multiple sound sources effectively. This makes disentangling group conversation difficult or impossible. And when faced with a very loud sound, such as a live band or even a fast-flowing river, my implant simply whites out, nor can it filter out background noise. 6 months on, I can still hear my own breathing, the kind of sound a healthy ear naturally mutes, though I have learned to filter it out by focusing my attention away from it. And so I enter a new world where every tap, squeak, clang, whisper, and consonant exploded and sizzled inside my head. The air was filled with a flutter of whistles and flutes in the highest register of ambient noise, my hair rustling, clothes brushing against each other, door hinges squeaking. Every sound had a limitless resonance. Pattering feet set off tinklings that endured. My dog's bark set off sympathetic changs and chungs in the radiators through the house. I can understand speech much as I used to with hearing aids. I still need to lip read and cannot cope with groups. And although I need subtitles for audiovisual media and cannot understand voices on the radio or the telephone, after 2 years of total deafness, the cochlear implant is, for speech, all gain. But what about music? At first, piped Muzak in the car sounded like a chorus of squealing mice. Yet the fiddle duo Laura Risk and Athena Turgis, whose album Journey Begun was the first I played after the switch-on, filled me with joy. Their lines bold and clear, the pungent, biting timbre of bow on strings speaking to me like the voice of an old friend. I went through CD after CD, roamed YouTube sampling random tracks, and from there moved on to play the piano. Everything sounded different. Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan's Qalwali, the Khanovitz Qatar, Javanese Gamelan, Mozart's G minor quintet all sounded unrecognizable and awful, as did familiar pieces on the piano. All I made out was a heavily grunting bass with little instrumental differentiation. What I could hear best initially was music with a simple texture, with perhaps a clear voice foregrounded over light accompaniment. Music built on rhythmic principles or from the weaving of simple lines from unisons to consonants through dissonance and back again. Playing the piano was at first a distressing experience. I preferred playing with the implant switched off and simply listened to the music in my head. Then I picked up a tin whistle. Blowing through it, I immediately experienced pure sound, as though it were coming from somewhere under my breastbone. I played up and down the scale, hearing every note clearly. I tried other wind instruments lying around, a Javanese flute, a set of Peruvian pipes. All gave the same effect, in their distinct timbres. At a music shop, I tried orchestral flutes. These tones resonated in my mouth and throat, I could feel the refined quality, the honeyed sweetness of the more expensive flutes. Most of all, I could hear pitch. I decided to tune my harp, feeling that it must be possible to experience true pitch when the notes are created by direct contact with the fingers and the playing position holds the resonating sound box against the body. So I spent hours running up and down scales and arpeggios, improvising tunes, repeating interlocking patterns. My idea was to play and listen as much as possible, concentrating on fully experiencing the pitch. I experimented with intervals, singing them inside me as I played, trying to experience their unique qualities. Then I tested my actual voice against individual notes, using the tuner to compare them with what I was singing. And then I tried the piano again. To my astonishment, I found that the music no longer sounded featureless and flat. Even music that had fared particularly badly directly after the switch-on, such as Chopin's Nocturnes, now had shape and harmony. As I played on and on with increasing emotion, I realized that the top-down aspect of sound sense was now working in tandem with the various bottom-up sensory routes. The brain wants to make sense of what's coming in and collaborates with the environment to create its own perception of the sound. The extent to which the brain compensates for indistinction I discovered by listening to birdsong. The first time I heard a blackbird with my new high-frequency bias, I was stunned by its clarity and beauty and by the fact that it was so loud. I began to understand where composers such as Vivaldi, Schubert, and Messiaen got some of their inspiration. Alongside my progress with music, I've come to enjoy and even prefer listening to environmental sounds. I listen with endless delight to the dripping tap in the bath. I've also discovered a sound artist collective advertising a sound walk in Barrow in the north of England. Armed with field recording devices, we walked through the town toward the dock. In pairs, we don blindfolds and describe what we hear. At the dockside, we listen to underwater sounds with a hydrophone. Music and sound will never be the same again, but as an artist, I wouldn't want it any other way. This article is excerpted from Aeon Magazine. That's A-E-O-N. We'll take in one of the business articles this week. Insurance. Is Obamacare working? Get ready for round two of Obamacare, said Dan Mangan in CNBC.com. When the open enrollment season set to begin November 15th, federal officials are vowing that the technology debacle of last year's launch of healthcare.gov will not be repeated. They expect another 5 million or 6 million consumers to join the state and federal exchanges, bringing the total number of people covered to 13 million. But officials have pointedly avoided making the kinds of promises and predictions that burned them last year. One thing that seems certain is that consumers can expect more choice, said Jason Millman in WashingtonPost.com. The number of insurers selling on the insurance marketplaces is set to rise 25%. In theory, this extra competition should help keep premiums down. And an analyst expects costs will rise by a reasonable 6%. But the difference in what people pay will depend on where they live, as different areas of the country have far fewer plan choices. Part-time workers in particular should be on alert this year, said John Healy in the Los Angeles Times. America's largest employer, Walmart, gave lawmakers a concise lesson in economics last week when it announced that it was dropping health insurance for its 30,000 part-time employees. The move is entirely predictable result of the employer mandate, which takes effect in January after a one-year delay. Companies already feel squeezed by increasing health care costs, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. So it's only rational to jettison part-time employees onto the exchanges. Other chains like Target, Home Depot, and Trader Joe's have already done so. When there's a subsidized government alternative and no penalties for not covering people who work fewer than 30 hours a week, cost control logic says to send such coverage ballast over the side. Walmart's move may look like a cold-hearted mathematical maneuver, but it's actually a good thing for many of the workers, said David Graham in The Atlantic. When Trader Joe's cut insurance for part-timers, it was because workers could get similar plans on the exchanges for less. Many of Walmart's affected workers will be eligible for subsidies, which will make coverage extremely affordable. Others will qualify for expanded Medicaid and not pay anything at all. Walmart's decision actually shows that the Affordable Care Act is working, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. The sooner we move away from our system of employer-provided health coverage, an accident of history that serves neither employees nor employers very well, the better off we will be. Thanks to Obamacare, Walmart workers have health security that is no longer dependent on the generosity of their employer. And that's a development we all should welcome. On the health and science page, child born from transplanted womb. In a medical first, a woman in Sweden has successfully given birth from a transplanted womb. The baby boy was born prematurely in September, weighing just under 4 pounds. But both mother and son are healthy, reports BBCNews.com. The 36-year-old mother was born without a uterus, but she did develop functioning ovaries. Prior to the transplant, she and her husband, who asked to remain anonymous, produced and stored 11 embryos through in vitro fertilization. Doctors then performed the transplant using the uterus donated by a 61-year-old mother of two who had gone through menopause. The woman took a series of drugs to stop her body from rejecting the womb, and 6 weeks after the transplant, she menstruated, a sign that the organ was healthy. 1 year later, when doctors were confident the womb was functioning properly, they implanted one of the frozen embryos. The baby, named Vincent, was born 32 weeks into the pregnancy after the mother developed unrelated complications. "It was a pretty tough journey over the years," said the father, "but we now have the most amazing baby, and he may soon have company. At least two other women who have undergone womb transplants are expected to give birth in the next several weeks." Scan for impending dementia. Scientists believe they may have found a simple, non-intrusive method for detecting early signs of dementia before symptoms even start to appear. A team from the University of Geneva enlisted 148 seniors who were showing no signs of cognitive impairment and scanned their brains using an MRI technique known as arterial spin labeling. When the volunteers were checked for mental disintegration 18 months later, those whose original scans showed reduced blood flow to certain parts of the brain, specifically areas associated with Alzheimer's, were more likely to have developed memory problems. If the results are confirmed, researchers believe the scan, which does not require any dyes or other outside agents to be injected into the brain, could help identify potential dementia sufferers at an earlier age, allowing for preventive treatments to possibly slow its progress. "The scan is simple to perform," lead researcher Sven Haller tells The Times. "It doesn't require special equipment and only adds a few minutes to the exam." Sharing really is caring. Do you find that you enjoy activities more when you do them with someone else? According to new research, experiences both good and bad feel more intense when they are shared. In a limited study at Yale University, individual subjects were given two pieces of chocolate and put in a room with a researcher who is pretending to be a fellow participant. The subjects ate one piece of chocolate at the same time as the fake participant, and the second piece alone, while the researcher pretended to work on another task. Even though the chocolate was from the same candy bar, the volunteers consistently rated the first piece as tastier and more enjoyable. To test the effects of negative emotions, researchers conducted the same test with bitter, unpleasant chocolate. Once again, the subjects rated the first piece, which they ate with someone else, as more disgusting than the piece they ate solo. When people think of shared experience, what usually comes to mind is being with close others, such as friends or family, and talking with them, lead researcher Erica Boothby tells The Washington Post. We don't realize the extent to which we are influenced by people around us whom we don't know and aren't even communicating with. On the Talking Points page, Islamic extremism rooted in the religion itself? Is Islam inherently backward, intolerant, and violent? Americans have been skirting around the issue since 9/11, said Jonathan S. Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. But now, finally, it seems we are willing to start talking about what's motivating terrorists. Comedian Bill Maher opened the door to this discussion when he recently butted heads with Hollywood liberal Ben Affleck on Mahler's weekly HBO show. Mahler's aunt and fellow atheist Sam Harris argued that liberals who refuse to stand up against the misogyny, homophobia, religious intolerance, and violence in the Muslim world are betraying their liberal principles. No one, they said, can state what is plainly wrong about Islam without facing accusations of Islamophobia. When Affleck angrily accused the pair of pushing ugly and racist stereotypes, Maher pointed out that while many Muslims oppose terrorist groups like the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, polls show that about 20% of believers throughout the world admit that they share the militants' extremist beliefs. Maher has shined a spotlight on liberals' see-no-evil discomfort with frank truths about the Muslim world, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. Like President Obama, who claims that ISIS isn't even Islamic, Affleck insisted that violent Islamist extremists are the exception in an otherwise peaceful religion. Yet polls show that in a number of countries, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Egypt, Iraq, and Malaysia, the stoning of adulterers is supported by the majority of Muslims, while similar numbers support the death penalty for those who dare to leave Islam. But for liberals like Affleck, acknowledging the truth about Islam means jettisoning the comforting fictions of multiculturalism and admitting the superiority of certain Western standards. The caricature of Islam as a violent and intolerant religion is horrendously incomplete, said Nicholas Kristof in the New York Times. Yes, almost 4 in 5 Afghan Muslims support the death penalty for apostates, but in Indonesia, the most populous Muslim country in the world, only 16% favor such a penalty. And while it is true that the Quran has passages advocating violence against sinners and non-believers, so does the Bible. The vast majority of the world's 1.6 billion Muslims are peaceful and tolerant. Judging Islam on the actions of a tiny, violent minority is both wrong and offensive. There is no single Muslim world, said Dean Obadallah in thedailybeast.com. As a Muslim myself, I can tell you that Muslims across the globe have wildly divergent views on almost everything connected to Islam. Lumping us all together is like claiming that the opinions of the most conservative areas of the U.S. are representative of the whole nation. Nonetheless, in too many parts of the world, no other religion comes close to the menace and violence of Islam, said Andrew Sullivan in dish.andrewsullivan.com. None of the 10 bottom-ranked countries for women's rights are majority Muslim. In the Middle East, bloodthirsty Islamists are gleefully beheading hundreds of non-believers and terrorizing whole nations. Christianity has been through similar periods of intolerance and bloodshed in the past, but after a long period of painful self-examination, it ultimately left behind its anti-Semitism and its contempt for other faiths. In many of the most devout Islamic countries, in contrast, merely questioning Islamic teachings is punishable by death. How is the world's second largest religion ever going to evolve if it forbids free ideas and open debate? What both sides of this argument tend to forget is that religion is embedded in culture, said Reza Aslan in the New York Times. No one is guided by religious scripture alone. Believers of all faiths interpret their texts through the lens of their own cultural, ethnic, nationalistic, and even political perspective. That's why the Christianity of a member of a megachurch in Texas is so radically different from the Christianity of an impoverished coffee picker in Guatemala. The struggle to reform Islam in Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and other countries is as much cultural and political as it is theological. In that struggle, said Ramesh Ponuru in BloombergView.com, reforms are most likely to come from people who are Muslims themselves, not from snide Western atheists like Bill Maher and Sam Harris. If the West wants to win over young Muslims to a more tolerant and modern worldview, calling Islam itself the motherlode of bad ideas isn't going to be helpful. And a couple of notes as we wind down. The federal government's deficit for the 2014 fiscal year fell from $486 billion, a $195 billion drop from 2013. Measured as a share of the economy, the 2014 deficit was a 2.8% of the gross domestic product. During the Reagan presidency, the deficit averaged 4% of the GDP. The share of immigrants in the U.S. population rose last year to 13.1%, the highest level since the 1920s. In 1890, during a previous immigration wave, nearly 15% of Americans were foreign-born. And we finish with a quote from actor Tommy Lee Jones. He says, "Kindness and politeness are not overrated at all. They're just underused." Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.